I don't wanna go to work. I just wanna chill and play all day. Look him dead in the face and say, I wish I could just be still asleep while you work.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Jobs Blow podcast with Brianna and Josh.
The podcast for dreamers with day jobs.
Hey, we're so glad to be back after a year. We're getting ourselves started again. This is our fourth episode, fifth episode in. I don't know. We're looking forward to sharing even more inspiring stories as well as perspectives and on surviving life in a pandemic.
Yes, Josh, but this show, we actually have a dreamer, someone who maybe not got caught up in surviving the pandemic, although I think he might have had a little fallout. So we're going to jump right into today's show. Nobody cares what's going on.
Are you good? I'm good.
Okay, you good? Yeah. Today. And also, I feel like he's way more interesting. So
than whatever we did today.
Yes. So awesome. the name of the show is How a Business Shark Tanked a Shorter Workday. Guest is Stefan Arstel, which I usually butcher names, so I apologize if I did anything wrong. And I also have a terrible Ohio accent, so I can't help myself.
And you're going to love the name of the show once he starts talking. How a Business Shark Tanked a Shorter Work Day.
All right. Well,
Stefan, how are you?
Welcome.
Welcome.
Good, good. Yeah, and you nailed the name right out of the gun. That's pretty rare.
I'm not gonna lie. I actually looked up a video where someone said your name because the last guest that was on here had a tricky name. It was OJ, and I was fully prepared to do a with that one, and she was like, "No, it's Ojavla," and I was like, "Damn it!" So anyway.
Enough. Well, thanks for having me on, guys. I appreciate it.
No, thank you for joining us. So first question for you before we jump into your career path. Are you doing your dream job?
You know, it's pretty close to it. I'm working out of a beach club. We built the Tower Beach Club, which is an event space. And we built this so that we could, instead of paying rent, to collect rent. This was a cost-cutting venture, but now it's 4,000 square foot waterfront beach club that we work out of. We have offices in the back. So
where exactly?
This is in San Diego, California.
And that's where you are now.
Yeah, that's where I am now. And I mean, the overall company is a bunch of things. We've got Tower paddleboards, Tower electric bikes. We have the beach club. We have a new Tower e-bike repair facility. But this is sort of our corporate headquarters. But as far as is this the dream job? It kind of is, and I kind of got here by looking, at what do I want for my dream job? And this is something I did. I worked in the corporate world, not in the corporate world, really the startup world, but for a larger corporation. And I came out of grad school in 99. After about 5 years, went off onto my own. I always wanted to start my own business, and I started a company called BuyPokerChips.com. And I was doing that, and it just took off immediately. I thought I was going to retire. But then, like everything online, it commoditized and kind of started to go down a little bit. And then in that downturn gave me some time to think, right? And I was, I read Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Workweek at the time. And in that, there's something they do called dreamlining, really, which is sort of planning out your future career. Like, what are you going to be in 10 years? What do you want to do? What do you want to be? What do you want to, whatever? And then, take 3 steps back to that. And it made me think about what would be my ideal job, because I was really facing going back into the workforce as the poker chip company came down. And my ideal job at the time, I live in San Diego, on the beach. I would like to be the CEO of a surf company. And I would go on, exotic vacations to do, bikini photo shoots. And, it'd be this sort of cool lifestyle business, and it would fit in with Southern California. And that was probably 2007 or 2008.
Right.
But I had that sort of picture, because I had defined it. And then in 2010, a buddy took me out paddleboarding for the first time. And, I didn't even know what paddleboarding was, but I'm a horrible surfer because it's very hard to surf. But this paddleboarding was really, really easy. And I was like, wow, that's great. So I went and bought a paddleboard, but the paddleboard was like stupidly expensive. And I'm like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Why can't we just sell these for half price, not sell them in a store? And that's where I started to go towards that.
Wow. So a couple of things just to clarify on for all of us, right? So Tower Boards is a lot of the success you're having now and where you went on Shark Tank with, correct?
Yeah, Tower Paddleboards is the company that I pitched. Right. on Shark Tank.
So two questions for you right off the bat. Why, where Tower, where is this word Tower comes from? Where did, how did that become the name that links everything? And also, can I come stay with you in San Diego right now? That'd be awesome.
Sure, sure. Of course. We're always having guests out here. The Tower came from, I mean, I have an MBA. So while I'm like an internet marketing guy, I have like a pretty solid, you know, business background, and I wanted to start a paddleboard company. So I was looking at, you know, like what would be good and symbolic for a paddleboard company. And really I was thinking, we're going to start in paddleboards and then we're going to go like these surf companies. I thought of it as a surf company. Right. We'd go into clothing, we'd go into stuff like that. So it had to be something that was friendly for that. And so I needed sort of an iconic logo, and the lifeguard tower seemed like a good logo. So I did a 99.
Oh, the lifeguard tower. I got you.
So right. When you, in 2010, how long had paddleboards been around? So from like a perspective of starting a business, like was it like the wave, you were just getting right at the top of it? Like how long had they been around?
You know, they've probably been around where they were popularized again for 5 years, and there were probably 80 companies making paddle boards. Most of those were going through direct retail, but it was kind of a new thing. But I live right on the bay here in San Diego, so I was seeing it. It had started in Hawaii a few years earlier, and it was sort of coming out of the surf industry.
These are surfboards, you standing surfboards with a long paddle, with one paddle you're holding, yes?
Exactly. An oversized surfboard, but it's not, you don't really have to do them in the surf. And that's it. Okay. Came out of the surfing industry, and everybody looked at it like that. But when I got it, I was like, man, this thing's kind of like a kayak. So, you know, it's, there's a much bigger market than surfing. Like not too many people will venture into the surf. It was a lot easier to surf for me, mm-hmm. for sure. But I saw it as, wow, this is a much bigger market than most people realize. And, you know, we're not going after the surfers. We're not going after the racers. We're going after the big, like, market, the lakes.
Middle.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. So it was kind of specialty at that point, and you were envisioning it to take it more mass when you
started. And I'm an opportunist. You know, I was just like, you know, where is the opportunity here? I didn't get into it for my love of paddleboarding or my expertise of paddleboarding, which a lot of people that were in this business were basically in. I was looking at it very objectively, and that helped us in a lot of ways. There was no inflatable paddleboards when we started, or they were really crappy. And I just liked, I knew internet businesses, so I needed a more compact paddleboard because these big boards were a pain in the ass to, you know, ship by freight. 15% were getting damaged. They got shipped back to us. Nightmare business.
Right.
So I really wanted an inflatable paddleboard to work. So we just made inflatable paddleboards thicker, solved that issue, and inflatable paddleboards went from 1% of the market to well over 70%.
Wow.
So why don't you take us to how you got from big idea to Shark Tank?
So that is somewhat random. I mean, because my expertise is sort of search engine marketing. So we figured out how to get to Google at the top for if somebody searches for, I want a paddleboard or something like that, or poker chips. You know, the poker chips were actually on TV too. And because I'm able to do that, it makes our company can appear even at an early stage in a new industry where it's not defined who the players are. It makes us appear to be one of the top industries. So Shark Tank called me out of the blue one day.
Oh, really? They called you?
Called me. And I had never heard of the show. It was in season two. We were on fairly early. And I've got a few media calls, and media always calls, or these certain salespeople call in media, and they get you all excited about the media. You're going to be on with this fancy host. And then at the end of this hour, they tell you, oh, and there's a $19,000, you know, pre-production fee for this. And I'm just
like, oh yeah, by the way, there's a $19,000 pre-production fee for this.
Oh, the podcast too. Yeah. And so I've had that call so many times. I was like, Shark Tank. I thought because it was paddleboards, it had something to do with water. I didn't understand what the name even meant.
That's funny.
And I was like, I don't mean to be rude here, but I want to cut to the chase because we get two kinds of media, and I just want to, you know, make sure this is, there's no
for play or am I actually going to be on?
You guys like, no, this is on ABC on Friday night. And I'm like, and it's on, how have I never heard of this show?
Right.
Sounds like something I'd be really interested in. And they were just in season two at the time. And right. I said, sure, I'll be on the show. So I was, you know, pitching 5 weeks later.
Which you then realize, if anybody, you know, I'm a big Shark Tank fan. I've learned a lot from that. in both trying to start businesses, but also just realizing ideas, some ideas aren't great, but they love that. They love so like companies that start that are just selling on the internet or that grow, you know, huge, you know, the beginning, they're just, even if it's only $100,000, it's all from online marketing or their website. So you must've been just a real, exactly what, you know, right in their wheelhouse, especially for Mark and some of the other guys on there who started their careers in that same way.
Yeah. I mean, the producers, they want entertaining companies. The sharks want actual good investments. There's right. two different audiences here. But, you know, we had $35,000 in lifetime sales at the time that call happened, but it was kind of right. going into summer. So by the time we pitched, which was, I think, 5 weeks later, we had $100,000 in lifetime sales.
Wow.
And still, when I said $100,000 in sales, you know, the sharks were, you know, whatever. They also didn't like the paddleboard business to begin with. Right. But we've done $40 million in sales since then. So,
well, so can you tell us, because I did watch the clip from your appearance on there.
What and it season was the part to watch?
It was two, season two.
Season two, what, episode 10, you said?
No, we were season three. Season three, episode nine, but nine. It's
and it, you have it on your website. That's where I saw it, the clip. So tell me what happened, because I didn't have a lot of context, and the music they put behind you was like not helping. I was like, oh my God, this is so horrible.
Yeah, I'm known as the worst pitch in the history of Shark Tank that still landed a deal. And so I went on there, and I, like I said, I hadn't seen the show. I was worried about remembering the names of all the sharks. And then they sequestered me in LA for like 4 days. And I was trying to robotically, you know, like remember this 2.5 minute pitch. I'd have no memory. I don't, that's not an ability I have, okay. But I was sort of forced to do that. And then they told me 2 days into it, oh, you know, Mark Cuban's one of the sharks. And I'm like, well, I know that guy. He's my target. But when I went in there, I actually wasn't even nervous at all, but they gave me a little clicker right before I went on. It was a slideshow, and I'm going through my robotic pitch, and I get to my first slide, hit the clicker, and it shot through all my slides. And then I'm trying to like back up while I'm on, and it's everything's live. It's not like they're doing retakes. They want you to sweat it out under the light.
My oh my God. Gosh.
And oh, so you was sabotage. I think it was sabotage.
I had heard
your error on the remote.
I heard that those meetings, that those shoots are like hours long, and they're stopping and starting, and you're waiting around, and they're brutal.
Yeah. I mean, it can be like, I mean, mine was probably an hour and 15 minutes, and you know, they take that down to 12, 15 minutes is whatever. So what you're seeing is a highlight film of what goes on there. Right. So, and that's why, you know, while it was a horrible start and I froze and then they made fun of me, I got called a leprechaun. I got called a nerd.
Right.
Three of the sharks went out. And then at the end, I had a bidding war between Cuban and Mr. Wonderful. Right. And so to condense that down from this guy's a complete idiot and everybody's going out to, you know, Cuban's offering to invest in any business this kid does in his future. It was a tough edit for them. And it didn't make much sense in how they did it. And so people think I got lucky, basically.
Let me ask you a question just from a TV production standpoint. So two things. A, how much of that, even though you're saying those guys want to make a deal, how much of that do you think is TV? You know, obviously not that much, because in your case, he's still a business partner and he invests in 30% of, you know, all your businesses, right? But like, A, how did you get a sense that maybe they're just messing with me and this isn't going to happen and it's just TV? And also, is there like downtime with them? So like after the shoot, do you really walk out those doors and just not see them again? Or are you on set and you're chit-chatting with them? How are you? You know, that kind of thing?
No, you don't see them before and you don't see them after, and you walk out the door. And they got other, I mean, they shoot the whole season at that time. They shot it in like, you know, 4 days or something, you know, and they were right. maybe 13 episodes or not 52 episodes, but within 13 weeks.
Interesting.
So yeah, you're in and out. And that is an excellent question you have, because I think it's different by the shark. Like some of those trying to get, you know, their TV time, especially early on, where they would offer a lot of deals and then they don't close those after the fact.
Right.
Just because you get on there and you pitch to them doesn't mean you're going to get a deal. And more importantly, at the time when I was on there, it doesn't even mean you're going to air. Like, you know, 50% of the pitches were airing, you know, so you, you had to entertain, you know, to air.
Right. You had to be a good story and you had to be a good business and it had to, So you're saying too, that there could have been, sorry, Brianna, there could have been people that got deals that didn't make the show.
for sure. And the I was worried about that. And that's what the producers told me. And they said, like, you're super boring. And it wasn't that exciting. Nobody was really interested in this. But man, when you made an ass out of yourself and then you came back, this was like a Rocky story. We love this.
Yeah. Right. That's what I was going to say.
On reality TV, I didn't realize
it. Yeah, no, that clicker actually not sabotage. It actually was really beneficial. Well, one of the things I read today too is that you are one of Mark Cuban's, one of his five favorite Shark Tank investments he's made.
Yeah, I think we're actually his best investment in the history of the show. If you look at the, because he put in a pretty small amount of money on us, you know, $150,000 for 30%. And I've cashed him out over $1 million in dividends and he still owns his chunk. And you know, we haven't had an exit or anything like that. So he's very happy. We were just an ATM machine for him for a while.
So when did you start then moving forward with, because I know now it's more beach products, like some you've done other items outside of the paddleboard. So when did you start?
Well, I had this fear because I was in the poker chip market before with my buypokerchips.com company, and that thing peaked to where I thought I was going to retire and it came down, and I just feared that happening again. And I was pretty confident it was going to happen in paddleboards, and it kind of did. Instantly I was diversifying. I was like, okay, let's take these profits and let's start other businesses and something like that. And we went into a lot of different businesses. We did a sunglass company. We did some snorkel equipment. We did skateboards. We did bikes. We did, we were just going into sort of every direction, almost like frantically diversifying. But then the diversification ones that hit was Tower electric bikes. And really we make beach cruisers, but that is just exploding. And that's really going to be the future of our company. But we're still a beach lifestyle company. Everything fits underneath that, you know, where you've got the lifeguard tower sort of iconic logo. Everything sort of fits under this is the rule.
And how much of that is gut and how much of that is just trying to is just research? I mean, obviously all of those different things you mentioned were beach oriented, right? Boardwalk oriented. And that's, I get that, but like, you know, you know what I'm saying? From an entrepreneurial spirit, is that gut choices or where is that coming from?
Or throwing stuff at the wall?
Right. Like,
yeah. You know, I've been in the online space since 1999. So I'm actually kind of an online veteran. So I have a good sense for what's going to work well as an e-commerce product. So that's one angle of it. And then I'm an SEO guy. So I really know, and it used to be, you could tell, you know, specifically what people were searching on and then how many people were providing content for those searches. So you can find these pockets of opportunity. And all the good businesses I've done is like you identify opportunity and you fill that.
So you're working backwards in a way. That's so interesting.
Start a business, in my opinion.
Well, I mean, it really, right. Cause I always say like, right. Fill a need, you know, not just a want, like, you know, fill a need. Right. But then sometimes people are like, I just want to do this. I want to make a t-shirt company and I'm going to go with it. And sometimes it hits and probably most of the time it doesn't, you know? So it's interesting that you really have an actual, so what he's saying is, you know, find your way of scanning the market and seeing where the gaps are and figure out products or ideas that go into those gaps. Yeah.
And it's harder to do that now. Like, I think there's windows of opportunity in the world. And there was just this wide window of opportunity when you could get the raw data of what people were searching on Google. It's all been obscured now because Google wants that for themselves and probably to monitor that.
Well, an entrepreneur, I mean, that word in this country, I mean, it's so, you know, commonplace. It's just everybody feels like they're an entrepreneur. Not everyone actually is. But you're also an author. Yes.
Sure. Yeah. And that we sort of fell into that one too. I barely got out of, you know, high school English. That was always challenging. The math was easy for me, but English was tough. And so the thought, you know, coming out of college, even that I would ever write a book, I would have never thought about it. And the reason I did that is 2015. In 2014, we were the fastest growing company in San Diego as a 5-person like surf company, basically. Like people were laughing. Like, you got to be kidding me. There were like VC backed, you know, bio companies and stuff like that. This event, and they're like, this is ridiculous. They don't even take surf companies seriously in San Diego.
But it's fun. You're like the CEO of fun.
Yeah.
You know, everybody wants fun.
But we were an innovative company because we were innovating on the distribution channel. We were going direct to consumer and we're giving you half price paddleboards. Now we're doing the same thing in, you know, electric bikes. It's so that is a real, it's like Netflix didn't innovate the movie. They just changed the distribution of it. And that is really where a lot of innovation comes from, you know, today. But so we were a fast growing company and we had a chance to become a big, big $100 million company, I thought. And how do we do that? So I started researching that in about, you know, 2014, 2015. And what I read this book, it's called like, what was it? It was like What Great Brands Do. And I was talking about these great brands. An interesting thing is they don't give back. Like they feel what they do as a company is giving back. So, you know, Southwest Airlines, they're creating, you know, turning airplanes into like the bus system or as cheap as the bus system. They don't need to give back to some charity. Their business model is a charity. So, and then another thing that was just sort of an interesting side note, but another thing.
Super obnoxious.
They
They live their brand. And we are this, you know, surf company that is working startup hours, you know, two blocks from the beach, not surfing. Right. So I'm like, we gotta start living our brand. How can we live our brand? And honestly, I was like, okay, you know, we've had a great run here. I've taken care of my investor. I got this good lifestyle, flexible. Like, how do I give this to my employees? And how do I motivate my employees so I can attract like really good employees, the people that work three times the speed? Right. So that's when we rolled out the test in 2015 of a 5-hour workday. And we were going to do it for 3 months. We ended up doing it for 2 years solid. And then we did it summers after that. And I was also just sort of writing in magazines. And a lot of this was to get, you know, publicity for the company or as an entrepreneur expert and stuff like that, you know, Entrepreneur Magazine, Inc. Magazine, Forbes and stuff like that. And I had written different, you know, articles about online business and stuff. But then when I started writing about the 5-hour workday, it was off the charts interest.
Because everybody's been evolving the workplace. I mean, for the last 10, 15 years, it was nobody has a desk. And, you know, I mean, it's been
nobody has an office.
Yeah.
It's one big open environment.
Everybody's in cubicle. Like, it's been evolving. And I think it is interesting. I mean, in the pandemic, now look, everybody's working from home. Who's going to go back? So you definitely, like, that was a great angle to get attention for your company.
And what were the hours? Like 9 to 10, 11:30 to 12:30. 2:30 to 2:45. Like, how'd you break up the 5 hours? Like five in a row?
So it was very scientific here. So we did, we were doing 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. because we wanted to get off, like where your work week would be better than most people's vacation week when you don't even roll out of bed till noon anyway. So we get up a little early, do that. And we cut out lunch, which was critical because there's a huge amount of waste around lunch, right? You have some people who do a half an hour lunch at their desk. Some people who do an hour and a half. Then you got to figure out where to go to lunch. And then you come back from lunch and you have like the food. I mean, like I figured at the time we were 9 to 5 with an hour lunch. So that was only a 7-hour day. Right. I figured you get rid of lunch and all the waste around it going to 5 hours. We're like, this is like magic. We're like not even going to that much shorter of a day. But we went to the 5-hour workday and I said, I told everybody in the company, I said, I'm giving you your life back. You're going to have more of a life like, you know, an entrepreneur. Heads down, no wasting time. If you can't figure out how to be as productive or more productive, you're going to be fired.
Yeah.
And so put pressure on them too, which is the same incentive that an entrepreneur has.
Sure.
Because you don't sell, you're going back into the job market, you know, because you're going out of business.
So let me ask you something, because I find it to be very generational, being Gen X. Like I grew up in the workplace where I didn't have distraction. If I wanted to be distracted, I had to pick up a phone and call somebody. There was no social media. There was the internet was new.
Right.
So did you, because my thing is when I go into work, I put my head down. I want to do my work. I want to get done. I don't want to stay until 7. So did you find that from a generational perspective that some of the younger people maybe because of those distractions, like didn't really appreciate like the let's get this done in and out 5 hours?
Well, I think you have one half of the equation there of really why we did this. And I figured like I work about a 5-hour day and I've been doing that for 15 years up to this point. And I'm like, and I'm pretty successful and everybody I know works kind of like me. Why am I making them stay, you know, the full day? And it has to do with productivity tools, right? All of this connectivity that you're talking about,
right?
It on the one side, it allows you to waste time, but on the other side, you have nuclear power at your fingertips. I mean, you know, 30 years ago when my mom was working in a bank, you know, her phone was tied to the desk and she wrote letters to people and put them in the mail. She was managing a bank. And I'm talking about, you know, in the 80s.
Wow.
And that's crazy. Like today, if the internet goes out at our office, we just go home. Like there's no point to even be there.
But, right.
Right? And so that's the nuclear power we have. And the if you look at the, when I started to write the book, I looked at like the history of work and, you know, workplace productivity. Productivity in the US has gone up 80% between 1970 and 2011, 80%. And I'm like, that's an insane number. And I'm kind of pissed off about that as like an employer, because it should be up 1,000% for sure.
Right.
And so there's, people are wasting their time.
You're just saying because people are in the office so much. Is that your point?
What's that?
You're saying because people are in the office and working so many hours, it should be 1,000%. But that it only went up 80 is
yeah.
Something's up with that.
Somebody's lying here. Like, they're just right. Wasting my time. I'm wasting their time. And in America, where we're very, like, we pride ourselves on the 60-hour work week, you know, we're working longer and we're still going to do 2 or 3 hours a week. So let's stop the charade, squeeze people.
Right.
Like, finals week. What can they really do in a short period of time? Train them to work fast.
I got to be honest with you. I just got to share this little anecdote. Is that the Brianna, the last job that I got laid off from, right? Before I was whatever, the full time of that position, right? I was basically working a 5-hour day, right? The job that I was hired to do could be done between 1 o'clock and 6 o'clock. There was no point in being there at 9 or 10 in the morning. So I didn't come in. My boss was cool with it. She let me do it. She was actually like an older person, right? She'd been there a long time. I was happy. I was productive. I was doing amazing things. As soon as new people came in, I was like, well, you got it. You got to be here 8 hours, not 8 hours a day. I was literally going in at like 9:30. I was dropping my kid off. And then sitting there till 1 o'clock doing like, it wasn't productive.
Well, but it is, it's all about appearances, because when I would go into agency and I had a child at home, I would go in, I'd put my head down, I'd get my work done. I would walk out every day at 6 o'clock. I did not feel bad about it, but people would still be at their desks. Some would be there till 9, 10 o'clock, whatever. Yeah. And I would hear shit because I left on, and I was like, no, if I do my work, nobody needs to be concerned. You know what I mean? Like so many, there were the young people that were getting overtime, good for them, you know, who during the day took time to chat and do their stuff. And then they stayed late.
When I got laid off ultimately, and it had an HR, and I was like, listen, I'm just letting you guys know that you guys created this problem, right? Like I was super productive and doing and you guys needing me to be here and sitting at a desk and do nothing created your own problem. So like, it just was so interesting. That was what, 2017. So like, whether it worked or not, or the book changed the industry, or not, there is merit to this 5-hour deal. If you're really focused, you're doing your work during that time, it can absolutely be productive.
But tell us why you don't think it worked.
Yeah. Well, you know, revenues in the company went down overall, but there's a lot of factors in there. You know, we're the paddleboard industry, you know, the poker chip business before went down too. So there's a lot of other factors in here. So I don't blame it entirely on the 5-hour workday, but the big reason why I started the 5-hour workday was I wanted to attract and retain the people in the work that do 3 times the work of everybody else that work at that faster clip. Kind of like you said, you walk out of the office and the people who are really getting raises are the people who stay there till 7, and whether they do anything or not. And that's really like disconcerting to me. When they right. And you see this just buffoons that are these presidents of these companies, and you're like, right. How did you get there?
Oh, I love that you're saying this, because Josh and I say it, and I don't think it holds much water when we say it.
So, but I was like, okay, I'm going to renegotiate with workers. And my payback here is I'm going to get the people that work at 3 times, and I'm going to repel the people that can't work at that pace. So that was why I was going to fire you. And I was pretty serious about that. We're going to get rid of you. So that was the theory. But the thing is, it didn't work. That didn't happen. Like, I was already attracting great talent, and I was getting people straight out of college and super smart kids. But they were young, so they would only stay here for, you know, 2 or 3 years or something like that. And I was paying them $36,000 a year in San Diego, which even at the time wasn't a lot of money. So startup salary and working them like that. When we did the 5-hour workday, I thought that would, you know, I would maintain that. But really, I was able to attract those people because we had sort of a sexy company. Like, we were a beach lifestyle surf company. We were also direct to consumer, so it was a little techy, you know. And then when we got the Shark Tank investment, you know, we had all of those things working for us. The 5-hour workday was like a nice benefit, And when we rolled it out, everybody was there, like they earned it. I mean, because they worked hard. So when they had it, it was great. But all those people sort of cycled through the company within, you know, 3 or 4 years anyways. And then we had a whole company that didn't actually earn it. Right. And it became an entitlement. And, you know, and the reality is it didn't change my retention or my ability to attract people at all. Like that
right.
These kids, they came into a company because it was cool and it was hot and they stayed there while it worked for them. And then they left. And the right before we stopped doing the 5-hour workday, there was a 90-day period where I lost 4 of 9 people in my company. Wow. That were leaving a 5-hour workday. You know, one of them was making, you know, $70,000 a year. You know, these were young kids with good pay. And
what was the reason why?
Just for various reasons, you know, but it was, you know, millennials sort of, and they were, you know, one wanted to go live in Mexico. One wanted to go travel, do the van life. Another one wanted to go to an agency.
Well, they had more time to think about these things. They're leaving at one. They're getting their maps. They're looking around. They're like, I want to go to Mexico. Now I plan the trip.
Yeah. Your life gets much, much, much bigger, but the motivation really of bringing in good people isn't about how much they're going to work or how little they're going to work or how much you pay them. Like we now raised, it doesn't matter if I pay somebody 80 and they leave and 2 years before they were making 36 and they came. They don't care about money. I think we live in a very privileged world when things like this happen. They don't care about money. They don't care about the work hours. They care about the mission of the company and stuff like that. That's how aligned are they with the interests of the company, which is a great thing for companies, I guess, if you're in those things. But the 5-hour workday didn't work for that. And I was just befuddled by that. But what it did work for was it gave us a mentality of productivity. And we became a company that identifies productivity tools, and which is, you know, a lot of the stuff you're seeing now, it was an artificial constraint that forced us to get creative. And startups have artificial constraints, and that's why they're successful. COVID, interestingly, put these artificial constraints on business in mass, right? And people having to come up with creative things. So this has been forced upon everybody now. So the 5-hour workday failed in that sense, but we're still doing it now, but we do it only in years after we've increased revenues, right? Then it's like a company benefit for everybody for 4 months.
Right, in the summer, right? You just do it in the summer months?
We're moving it to the fall because in San Diego, the best months are August, September, October. And so we're going to do it August, September, October, November. And then it is high season kind of at the early part of the
season. But I can't imagine that you've relaxed. It's not like you went back to like, let's be 8 hours working your ass off 60 hours a week. I mean, it seems that you're still focused on the productivity side. So if you need the time, I mean, I'm totally guessing here. I have no idea. But like, right? Like you didn't go back to being like a, you know.
We were never a crazy startup. Yeah. You know, we were never serving, you know, bringing in chefs for dinner at 8 o'clock or anything like that to keep people chained to the desk. But we work 8:30 to 5:30 with a 1-hour lunch. And I encourage people to like go surfing at lunch or go do something because we want a high level of work. Go ahead.
No. So when you did implement the 5-hour workday, if people wanted to stay, they could stay, right? I mean, it was like, this is what we're doing. But if you have work and you want to stay, we're not forcing you out the door. We're not telling you have to get it done in 5 hours.
Yeah. So, and that's actually who it's a salaried position. So you're getting the same. And if you're working, you know, 9-to-5 day, like in a lot of companies, like you'll stay till 8 or 9. I mean, even if it's not an oppressive company, if you're on a big project, you do that. You work when you have to work. And any good employee does that, right? So the same expectations were with the 5-hour workday. And for some people, the motivation was there. Like we had one person that went, he's a surfer. He has a 5-hour workday. I believe he was dating a girl at the time. And he said, I want to go to China and live in the factory for 6 months, working, you know, 12, 6-hour days. So
in your factory or the factory making this
Chinese
this product. Yeah.
Like sleeping on a cot with rats and just like crazy. I'm like, I don't want to go to China. You can go to China for sure. But that's how he was looking at this. And that's actually the people that I was trying to attract. He's actually back at the company now. Those people, I wanted everybody to get in sort of the owner mindset of this. So it really wasn't about like, because some people came into it, I only got to work 5 hours a day. It was more like, if my job only requires 5 hours a workday, I'm not staying around to put on like a dog and pony show here. But at times you got to work, and that's, you know, that's income.
Right. So So let's talk a little bit about this other venture you have going on, the No Middleman. Because it sounds to, is it kind of like an idea of going up against an Amazon, like cutting out that middleman?
Yeah. So we had this run up in the paddleboards. At the peak, we capped at about $7.5 million in revenue. And then we started to go down. And part of the reason we went down is we decided about in 2017 that Amazon was not the future for us. Amazon was the future for Amazon, right?
Right.
And at the time, more than 50% of our revenues were on there. And we were, you know, we were in Jeff Bezos' letter to the annual stockholders. Tower Paddleboards and Stefan Arsdal is mentioned in there as like the, you know, poster child for this company they're helping out. And they were great, you know, on the run up. But then it became more and more expensive to sell through Amazon. It became more and more crowded. So you had to advertise through Amazon. And it became very apparent that we were sort of, you know, riding the tail of this tiger that was about to turn around and eat us.
I worked for a cookie company and they, you know, sell through Amazon. And I was trying to help with the marketing on it. It is insane how they continue to just take money and like trip you up. It is really, it's masterful. It's what he's got going on there.
And it's hard on brands. I mean, yeah. So we saw that early and I was just like, when I see something, I don't like try to hang out because I saw retail get upset. Right. And I said, the same things happen to direct to consumer brands. So I'm like, we're getting off Amazon. So we walked away from 4 million in revenue, and doing that is kind of hard in a company. You got to right size everything. And then there were other external factors going on there. But I was like, I don't think it's a good plan for Amazon too. Like it's the everything store, but what if all the good brands leave? And you'll see about a year ago, Nike left Amazon because they decided we don't actually need Amazon. They don't.
Right.
And now today Amazon takes probably 50% of the revenue of most transactions on there. For what?
Right.
And to do that as a direct to consumer company, you have to elevate your prices back to retail. So in this weird world, we got rid of all the middlemen, and now Google and Amazon have become these ultra powerful middlemen, and we're back to retail. So consumers have no benefit of basically globalization, and the brands just become more profitable. And, you know, Jeff Bezos becomes the richest man on earth.
Talk about someone who doesn't do anything for anybody or give anything away.
To mention that some of these brands, if you were on Amazon, you couldn't even find the best selection of things. Yeah, even still, like if I wanted a certain kind of sneaker, I still would have a better chance of getting that on Nike's website than I would at any kind of fulfillment from Amazon.
Yeah, a lot of brands weren't going all in, especially the big ones, and the smart ones were not. Like Toys R Us went all in, and now they're
gone. Gone.
Yeah. Right?
But so the no middleman idea is the concept of we don't really need Amazon because now it's just sort of a search engine for products. It's sort of an information source. So if we can just do curation and we go find the 3 to 5 best people who make, bread makers, and the 3 to 5 best people who make this, and not just bake the best, but also giving it the best value. So these direct to consumer brands, and there's thousands of these, right, that are popping up every day. And so we aggregated, right now there's maybe 400 or 500 that we've aggregated and curated. And only if this is a great brand selling great products and put them into, 3,000 or 4,000 categories that will eventually grow to, basically Amazon's catalog, about 15,000 categories. And it's just an information source. It just took a couple people, some time to put this together. And we don't take any percent of the revenue. You go on there, you find the company, and then you go to that brand and buy direct from them. And why was this created? Because I saw, Tower Paddleboards and Tower Electric Bikes as, dinosaurs walking unless there was a lower cost customer acquisition fee. Because then what was going to happen in the U.S. economy here is you have Amazon selling everything and China making everything, and neither of them pay taxes, and we're in a consumer economy. So you've opted all consumers and all businesses out of the consumer economy. And so there will be a reaction for sure. And I think it's going to come in the form of curated storefronts, and no middleman is sort of an experiment to do that. We did have a revenue drop, so I've just sort of put that off to the side for now. And it's just sort of, it's very useful information there. Mm. We're not monetizing it or anything like that. As once we get our businesses right and we grew 100% last year, then we'll go back to that.
So, you said the word experiment. It's sort of an experiment, and all of these ideas, right? It's sort
the
of an experiment. It's sort of an experiment. Paddleboards, sunglasses, it's sort of an experiment. How did, talk to us from the entrepreneurial mindset and spirit. This is something that we ask a lot of our guests too. Is like, where does there's this DNA in people like you who just go with an idea or go with where does that motivation come from? You know, how do you act on it? How do you push yourself to go through and not just, you know, like Mitch Hedberg had, you know who Mitch Hedberg is, the comedian? He had this joke that was always like, sometimes I'm going to butcher it, but basically like sometimes the pad for me to write a joke down on is on the other side of the room. So I have to convince myself that my idea is not that funny. Right. And like, you know, that's like the lazy side of it. Right. But sure. For you is like, where does that come from? And that ability to take those chances that maybe don't work.
Yeah. I mean, I think all companies experiment, but it becomes really important as the world moves faster and faster and you have constrained resources. You have to do experiments in ways where you're not going to get, you know, lose a boatload of money. You find experiments, and small companies can only do experiments that you can figure out how to do. Like 5-hour workday experiment did not cost us anything. My payroll didn't go up. I was paying the exact same amount, just people were working less, and it seemed like they were making more money or they were getting a better deal. But the important thing was it didn't cost me any more to do that as a company. Now we're an e-commerce company. So if I'm a paddleboard company and I want to start an e-bike company, I already have the customer service people. I already have the warehouse. I already have, you know, the marketing skill. So that's an easy experiment to do. So those are the types of experiments that we do. I think more advanced companies, you know, the Googles and the Amazons of the world are doing a lot of experiments. You know, that's why they're hiring, you know, 500,000 people, is because they're doing these high level experiments because they know they can pay off, and they do a bunch of those and, you know, just learn from it and grow. And that's why these big companies are a real problem today, because the number of experiments they can afford to do
and fail at
outpaces everybody.
Yeah. So is there, I want to ask you, is there anything you wish you had created or started that exists now? Or is there something that is your North Star that you're still, it's in the back of your mind and, you know, it's the dream thing for you?
You know, I've heard a question before, something like, what would you do if you knew it was going to fail? Right. So you're sure this is going to fail, but you're going to do it anyway. And so I'm kind of, you know, driven by that today, because I've achieved a certain level of success, even though, you know, the banks almost took my houses about a year ago and it can disappear at any time. But now I'm more like, okay, what do you really want to do? And what is interesting and what is worth doing? That's why the 5-hour workday, even though it somewhat failed, I'm not letting go of it. You know, I think there is validity there and we can do it in a different way. And more importantly than that, it's a worthwhile thing to do, because I absolutely believe people are wasting time at work, and the let's go all work 60, 70 or 80 hours a week is just killing people and not making them happy. And it's just dumb. So even if that fails, I'm doing an experiment. Maybe somebody else will hear about the experiment and they'll try their other experiment, and it's a worthwhile pursuit. So if I get hit by a bus tomorrow, at least I added something, right? And so that's really what I'm trying to go towards.
Right. It seems like it's like, you know, you have a shed in the back. You just want to try building this bar and you've never built anything before. And you're like, I'm going to build a terrible thing here, but I just want to keep building it because it's fun. And it's like, it's enjoyable for me. Right. I mean, there's a little bit of that. I just want to see where it goes. Right.
Yes.
I think you should add the 5-hour workday, sometimes. And then have a second book come out.
Well, I did like what in one of the interviews that you did, that you said about the people that did leave, that you felt some of it had to do with culture, and that people, I think your quote was, people don't leave companies, they leave people.
Yeah.
And it's so true. I mean,
that's something I didn't mention here is the other failure of the 5-hour workday is it broke our company culture. Why we had a very strong startup culture, just in general. You're working in the trenches with people. It's a small group of people. You form very tight bonds with those people, and those people form tight bonds with each other, right? And best friends, you know. And they don't leave that company. When we went to leaving at 1 o'clock, everybody's, the rest of your life gets much bigger. I mean, it's, you're just bored. I mean, like, especially me as like an entrepreneur, what I did is I used my extra time to start other businesses. And that's where we diversified into all these companies. I think it ultimately saved our business because of that diversification, because it freed my time to not just, you can focus 80 hours a week on the business, or you just focus 25 on that and then do some other stuff. I think that's a much healthier way to do it.
Well, your day suddenly turns into different days, you know, because you suddenly now have like two different like feelings in your day. You go in, you get that work done, and now you have this whole other kind of, you know, time that you never had before to do something with. I mean,
and you got to get creative in how you even feel that. It's an uncomfortable feeling for a lot of people that are used to this, like very defined. You go around the world, you meet an American. It's like, what do you do? What do you do? What do you do? That's the question you hear. I traveled through Australia when I was very young, and I went for 3 months without hearing that question because it was all Europeans. They didn't care. Nobody was doing anything. We were traveling for 3 months, and it was just so much more fascinating. So I think we've got to an unhealthy level of, What do you do? And, you know, okay, so stop work at one. What are you going to do that? And that is actually a much more interesting question. That also, and I think much that, human question.
That also goes along with, well, what are you? Like, what's your, what, oh, I'm Irish and Italian. Like, nobody in the rest of the world asks that. What are you? I'm French.
Yeah,
France.
Yeah.
I'm Australian. I'm from Australia. You know, nobody says American. I'm American. Well, leave me alone. You know, what do I, where am I from? But
so did you ever in the just to get to the name of the show, we always ask our guests, did you ever have a job that blew?
We haven't asked that this season yet.
No, because we've been talking a lot about pandemic.
Yeah, that's a good one. Stephen, you're the first one. Stephen, you're the first.
Yes, the worst job ever, which seemed like a dream job at the time, was I was in Hawaii and I was taking a 6 month hiatus with like five of my college buddies, and we were living in Hawaii in Waikiki, so we were there for 6 months. And it wasn't a great economy. So I was trying to be a bartender over there. And apparently all the bartenders in the world move over there. Right. So I couldn't find that. So I finally took a job on a cruise ship. That's a pretty decent job. But I was a busboy on a cruise ship. So you would think, this is great. This is an ideal job, right? I'm going to go around to the islands, work on this cruise ship. It'll be like the Love Boat. It was honestly,
that's such an 80s kid thing to think.
it was honestly more like a slave ship, honestly. Like,
oh my gosh.
It was crazy. You would start at 6:30 in the morning and work till 10:30 at night, 7 days a week. You would have a couple hours after breakfast and a couple hours after lunch, and you were on your feet. Like, after 3 days of this, I'm getting up and I would bandage my feet in the morning, the first thing, because your blisters are bleeding and stuff like that. And you make, you know, you're living on the boat, so you have no expenses. You got, you know, you're making $2.38 an hour at the time, because
it's a job
where they can pay you like slave labor wages. And you made, you know, you'd get tips every week, so you'd make like $500. But I was like, holy cow, I'm working like 77 hours a week.
What?
And this is crazy. I mean, literally, I was thinking, I need to just, like, when this boat is pulling off of out of port, I'm just gonna run out the back by the pool and just dive off the back.
Right.
Just to get off this boat.
Well, how long did you last?
3 weeks.
Wow. 3 weeks. That's impressive.
I think I got like two demerits because I was missing meetings or something, because it was just such a shocking job. But I was like, oh, that was just.
How do they justify it? How do they make people look at each other going, yeah, this is normal, buddy?
Well, like, this is the only ship in the world. The American Hawaii Cruise is that employs U.S. citizens. So usually this is people from third world countries.
I was going to say, yeah, that's probably,
it is.
Don't hear about
insane.
It.
And there's like a different part of the ship. And there's like as many people working on the ship as there are people like guests. And sometimes it's like 2 to 1.
Wow.
Go through one door and it's not the nice cruise ship anymore. It's like this like Navy ship where you're banging your head on stuff. And like,
oh my gosh.
So did you have like terrible like flashbacks when you see the cruise ships during the pandemic that couldn't come to port and people were stuck on those? Because I never worked on a cruise ship and I had nightmares for those people.
I've only been on one cruise ship, and it was an entrepreneur's cruise. So it was like 3,000 entrepreneurs, and they rented the whole cruise ship, and just like a short cruise. So that's the only one I've been on that was okay. But I just have no interest in going on a cruise ship. And I've seen the other side, and I'm just like, man, this is not a good, but I wasn't like, I'm not having flashbacks from that job. Like, it was that horrible. But it was very clear to me after a week, like, this job sucks. Like, oh,
I don't want to do this ever.
Do you have friends from there? Did you make any connections? Was there any crazy like fun to it? I mean, was there any that you do hear that sometimes that those guys live their own Well, kind of lifestyle.
There are great jobs on the cruise ship. Like if you're the activities coordinator for the kids or whatever, and you go up, well, that's a great job. And if a bartender was probably a good job, busboy, not
entertainer.
Entertainer. But still, you're on a ship. I think there's a. I don't know. I just don't think that's a good place to be.
All right.
I got to ask one last question before you go, because I was thinking about it before. Shark Tank calls you, Mark Cuban invests in you. Were you looking for an investor at the time? Was that part of your plan at the time, or that you just were like, oh, this just fell in my seat. Oh, here's Mark Cuban giving me $150,000. Like, was that going to happen for you anyway?
No. And I wasn't thinking about raising money because we were growing so fast. I think I had $100,000 in loans from my brother and one of my friends. And so I had some money and we were going along, and it turns out we were growing so fast that we did need to raise money, but I don't have any clue how to raise money. When they called, they said, you got to give your pitch in like 2 days. And I'd never seen the show before. So I asked them in my interview tape or whatever, 2 days later, for $5 million for 60% of my company. And they said, nobody's ever asked for this amount of money. And I have an MBA. Here's my projections. This is what this company is worth. Like, and they said, well, go watch the show. And I'm like, I can't watch the show. You guys don't put anything online. And so they sent me a couple episodes. And I said, this is like the weirdest investing I've ever seen. This is like they're betting on horses. Why would Mark, and it wasn't even Mark Cuban at the time, but I'm like, this guy seems to have a lot of money. He has a private jet. Why would he invest $50,000 in 20 companies and want the nightmare of this, right?
Right.
Like, it's a weird kind of investing on there.
Well, you know, and it worked out for you because you had that attitude, instead of all those people who are like, please call, I need to go on Shark Tank, you know, who have it all like figured out how they're going to present. And you're this guy that's like, what is Shark Tank? What do you want me to do? And then you walk away with this investment. And, you know,
the bigger thing, honestly, there was getting Cuban. As soon as they said Cuban, I said, wait, he's a celebrity. He's going to give us money. I would give him money to be part of my company. This is a right. That's a totally different investment, right?
Yeah.
Like $50,000 wasn't going to make a huge difference. But having Mark Cuban paddleboards as opposed to Tower paddleboards.
Right. Well, and being a shark and being Shark Tank winner, like there, you had a whole thing going for you. You won, you walked away a winner. You had him as a backer. Like those, you can't get better PR for.
Have you personally learned a lot from him too?
Yeah. And on that last point, at the time, Shark Tank was new. So we got a bunch of media, and I was an SEO guy, and we're trying to get links. So all of a sudden when Shark Tank called, the reason I was interested in going is I thought I could get a link from abc.com to my website. That was my big appeal. Not the money, not any of it, but I thought, God, that would be a link.
You are an internet guy. That's funny.
So we pitched every hometown newspaper, every college, every business journal, and we got a bunch of articles. And that's really what propelled us. It wasn't being on Shark Tank. That's like, 4 days and then it's gone and nobody cares who
you
are.
Right. But you could put that in it's in the story, right? You won. So that's still a nice.
Yeah. And what was your comment there, Josh?
As far as like, have you learned a lot? Are you in touch with him enough or that you've learned a lot from him, or is it just the money investment?
Yeah, I think he gives us more time a day than most companies because we have been one of his best, and I was just sending him checks. Most of my reports were like, oh, here's another $20,000, Mark. We're doing good. And so he, I do a weekly report to him, and, he's come out. We filmed another show called Beyond the Tank where he flew out here. We did that show, and then we went out to drinks with the whole company, and everybody got to meet him, and he sort of hung out for a while. So, he's been, very good to us. He's not like, doing introductions on my behalf, and he's certainly not doing any work for us, but he's a cheerleader for us. If he goes on, some kind of interview or whatever, he'll give us a shout out. He does it on social
media. He wouldn't open a door for you if you asked, like, and I'm not saying that facetiously, like, just like. Like if there was a, hey, we have this business idea, could you help us make this connection kind of thing? Or he doesn't do that?
Because you got to understand where he's coming from. He invests in 100 businesses. Yeah. And a lot of these businesses are like, he doesn't want to get into the introduction game. He doesn't want to, he doesn't do that.
Fail.
He's like, you can, and I negotiated up front before we signed the deal. I'm like, Mark, I want to put your face on the front of my website. Are you okay with it? And I was negotiating with his lawyers. I assumed I would have no contact with him.
Right.
They agreed to that. And I'm like, good, we're in.
Right.
I never expected him to do much. But then as soon as we inked the deal, they're like, okay, CC Mark on every email you send. Wow. Because he's going to get visibility into what we're doing. And if we kill this one, you know, he will invest in future companies.
Because he...
That probably makes him an even better entrepreneur, is because he is so, like, not just turning it over. He wants to know everything. And that probably makes him even better at what he does.
Well, you're not CCing him. You're emailing him, and CCing the other people is what the reality of it is. Because the first thing I sent to him, he responded in like, you know, 15 minutes, and he was swearing at me, "Don't be an idiot, don't do this and this." And I'm like, "What?
Wow.
Wow. That's incredible." Does he,
what do you do in that situation? Like, your gut says, "Oh, I was going to go this way." And he's like, "Absolutely not. That's a terrible idea." Then
That's a good point, because I learned, like, if I really want his opinion, because first I was sort of like a, you know, this little kid and asking for approval of the billionaire. And right. If he agree with me, I mean, okay, I gave 3 months thought to this, and he just, you know, turned it down 5 minutes. He's not really looking at these things. So if I know what I want to do, I do it and I inform him what I did.
Right. I was going to say, tell him. Feedback,
because sometimes when you're at the top of the company, it's hard to say, like, should you do it this way? Or should you? That's where I go to him and actually ask his opinion, and then I take his advice. But he's been very good with us. One interesting story on the no middleman project. You know, I worked for that a year, and I pitched him. Like, you know, I had a 25-page business plan, and then I took like 4 hours to write this email, and I was very sensitive, and I wanted to pitch him because it was potentially he was going to invest some more money in this. And I emailed him on a Saturday afternoon. In like literally under 10 minutes, I think it was 9 minutes, he replied. He had analyzed the entire business plan and he made a few tweaks. He's like, "I love it. You know, I'm not going to invest in it, but we'll just make it part of Tower. That'll be easy to do. But I think we need an auction system on this thing." In 9 minutes on a Saturday, I'm like, "What the hell?"
Wow. Well,
but it is a good, I think the lesson here is that we all have people that advise us and that we look to as more experienced and more knowledgeable. And you know, that was certainly my dad in a lot of ways. Every idea I came up with was always ask him and run by him. And sometimes I wholeheartedly disagreed, but I was like, well, he has done more than I have. So it was hard to decide who to follow. So I think the lesson here is probably, you know, do what you think is going to work. You know, if you're clearly, you know, thinking things out, and, you know, when it's time to really ask for someone's advice, then, you know, go to them and then take it wholeheartedly and see, you know, and decide in the moment if you're going to take it, right? I mean, how else that's to navigate?
That's one of the most uncomfortable things about being an entrepreneur that most people don't understand. When you have a boss that you get to throw stuff by,
right?
That's actually a luxury. Because you lose accountability, you can throw it by them. Okay, now the final call is on you. There's nobody above you. There's nobody. And it's just a very uncomfortable decision to make. And it's hard to do those decisions right because there is a lot of fear that creeps in there. So having him here is like a huge benefit on that front, because it's almost like a supervisor that I can't throw stuff to if I need to, if I'm comfortable making that decision.
Right. Like a sounding board.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think people have mentors for this, but I've always thought that's kind of like cheesy, and the business coaches and stuff. Right. I've never really bought into that, but this is nice.
So what do you have? Do you have any advice for our listeners who are chasing dreams or
stuck in a day job they want to get out of? And
I mean, have an idea? Just from my experience, I think the most interesting thing I did was define what my ideal job would look like. And literally I was just like, well, it would be, you know, a surf company CEO, because this, I would like this and this and this, and then just put that aside. And then, like, you know, 3 years later, I saw something and I said, you know what, like, this is really close to what I was talking about there. It's not surfboards, but it's paddle boards. It's the same things. We could go on these trips and do stuff. And now we do like all company trips to Costa Rica or, you know, Sayulita or something like that. And, you know, and then, okay, we'll have a 5-hour workday. You know, what else can we do that makes this sort of interesting? And then you can start creating around something that you've sort of envisioned. And it's not just like you wish it to happen. But the idea of defining, you know, what you actually want. I've done this in like relationships with dating too. Like usually you just go and you just sort of like, whoever's the hottest person in the room or the most interesting person in the room.
Right.
Nobody steps back and says, what exactly do I want? Right. That is invaluable.
Well, how much have I had to drink in this scenario too? You know, that also factors in.
I used to say that all the time with like people you ask you for dating advice, not that I'm a pro or anything, but like, you know, I would say like, stop thinking about like what's in your head about what you want. Like, just go, what do I need? Like, what is this thing that I'm looking for that satisfies my life? You know, and look for that.
Now we're into dating. We're all over the place.
All right, wait, let's brainstorm. Brianna, what do we want? Mark Cuban on the podcast. Oh, Mark Cuban. We're just vocalizing.
Is that the door you want him to open? Is that the door you want him to open?
I mean, look, maybe if he pitches Mark Cuban on a great 30%, he can have 30% of the next interview.
We could just have a Mark Cuban podcast where we just talk really, like, say nice things about him all day.
You should pitch him about buying the Padres and see if he wants to go in 30%. I mean, that's a good investment right there.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, so this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for your time. There's one last thing that we do since this whole pandemic thing has been going on. You haven't had COVID, I hope, have you?
I have, yeah.
And
I had it, and I still don't have my sense of smell or taste.
Well, there you go. So what we've been...
8 months later here.
How long?
I got it in May.
Oh my gosh.
So I'm hoping that comes back. I mean, if you're going to lose something, that's probably the best thing to lose. It's not losing your sight or anything, but it's pretty annoying because I was pretty excited about eating before.
Wow. No.
It just all has this chemically COVID like taste to it.
Well, this is a really interesting twist to our game because normally no one's had COVID. So really? I ask, what senses do you feel you've gained or lost during the past year? Meaning, you know, sense of family, sense of time, sense of perception. Da, 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 da. So we know you
smell and taste.
Yeah. So your answer is like, are there any other senses you feel you've gained or?
You know, I have a son that's in school and he's been doing the remote school and he's not doing well in school and he's, and it's just been a very tough thing for that. And he's a very, you know, bright kid, but just totally demotivated and that's a tough thing to get through, you know, and I'm trying to, you know, push and press upon him. Now I've got him like working in the warehouse, you know, so I'm trying to at least like establish some work ethic here, but I think we have like a few lost years of, you know, kids' lives.
Yes.
That has really been hard on him. And I think we're going to see like something, you know, in years out that society will change. And I think there's going to be positive effects of that too.
I think both. How old is your son?
He's 16.
That's tough. That's tough.
Socialization, 100%. But from someone whose dad gave him a job in his warehouse at 16, 17, I cherish those moments because lots of my friends during those times were not working. And I was working and I had a sense of time, responsibility. I had swim practice. I had a schedule, you know, like – it's going to benefit him. And I think 100% he'll be thankful for this in a lot of ways down the line.
Well, the socialization hasn't been a problem. I mean, he's got like, you know, 10 buddies over every day. He's just on the longest summer vacation of his life and failing.
Wow. Here's the thing. I always forget the way we live in New York is so different than so many other cities.
So different. I mean,
we've been locked down in our apartments, seeing no one because it was so awful here in the spring. Yeah. We're all scarred. Nobody wants to do that again.
Right.
So, nowhere to go. You're surfing and skateboarding and you're riding around on the e-bikes. Right. Like, he's just a free bird running around, but he's failing school and he's not concerned about it is the most important thing. He just sees this isn't real school. I think there's going to be, you know.
I think there's a cruise ship with his name on it.
I don't know. There's
the
education of dad's business. You know what I mean? I mean, you know, you learn a lot there too.
Well, again, thank you for joining us. Do you have any social channels or anything you want to promote?
So everything with Tower is at the Tower Beach Club. It's not just our beach club. It's our e-bikes and our paddle boards. We sort of put everything onto there. So you can just at Tower Beach Club for pretty much any of the channels. If you need to, you know, contact me or whatever, we're a very small company. So you can just go onto any one of our websites, towerelectricbikes.com, and just, you know, look at the contact us page, send an email in or find my email on there somewhere.
And it's spelled Steven, but it's pronounced Stefan. So everybody out there, when you email him or call him and leave a message, make sure you pronounce it the right way. Okay, guys?
I don't mind at all.
He's been called worse, I'm sure. All right. Josh, why don't you tell him our handles?
We are at Jobs Blow Podcast, jobsblowpodcast.com. Please go on all the sites. We're really looking for reviews right now. That's what we're really hoping for from anybody out there who's listening. Even if it's just gibberish, just give us a review, 5 stars if you can. Share, like, comment, tell your friends. I am at Mr. Josh Hyman on all my social. Brianna, what's yours again?
At Brihas.
All right. We did it. We got it out of her. Stephanie, right. Thank you so much for joining us. We really, really appreciate it. Good luck with everything. Tell Cuban we say hi.
Yeah.
All right. Awesome, guys. Thanks for the
opportunity. You. No, all thank right. you. Bye.
Very first light, Chief. Sharks come cruising. So we formed ourselves into tight groups. You know, it's kind of like old squares in a battle, like you see in a calendar, like the Battle of Waterloo, and the idea was, shark comes the nearest man, that man, he start pounding and hollering and screaming. Sometimes the shark go away. Sometimes he wouldn't go away. Sometimes that shark, he looks right into you, right into your eyes. You know the thing about a shark, he's got lifeless eyes, black eyes, like a doll's eyes. When he comes at you, he doesn't seem to be living until he bites you. And those black eyes roll over white, and then, oh, then you hear that terrible high-pitched screaming. The ocean turns red, and in spite of all the pounding and the hollering, they all come in and they rip you to pieces.